Welcome to Deep Dive into Water Safety. This is our going on our 6 month of reporting based on the Hawaii Water Safety Plan that brought to the attention that Hawaii has a very high drowning rate. We rank second highest in the nation, and our kids 1 to 15 are drowning at a higher rate, and local people are drowning at a higher rate than their population percentage. And only 2% of second graders have any water safety survival skills. Recently, the governor held up the water safety plan and said, if you read this and take it to heart, we can save lives. And today, I'm very lucky to have someone who is actually in this plan. I've had some other people, but today she's going to tell us what we need to know if we come across a jellyfish that has stung us or a Portuguese man of war. And this goes for locals, visitors, and anybody internationally or nationally that's listening to our show. So, welcome, Dr. Angel Yanagihara. And I hope I pronounced that right.
Yes.
Can you tell me how to pronounce that?
Yanagihara,
I
great.
did it well. Okay. So, you are a biochemist and toxinologist specializing in venomous marine invertebrates, especially box jellyfish. You're based at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, where you serve as associate researcher at the Pacific Biosciences Research Center and director of the Pacific Cnidaria. I don't know if I got that.
Cnidaria.
Okay, Cnidaria Research Laboratory. So welcome. I know you have much more we can talk about here. You've developed the Sting No More line of first aid products. You've served as the jellyfish and venom expert for marathon swimmer Diane Nyad's Cuba de Flor crossing, which we'll talk about. You've provided global leadership in understanding box jellyfish and I can well, venom and first aid protocols. And you've been represented in the Netflix film Nyad for your contributions to the swim safety team. So thank you. I want to start out by asking, how did you get interested in box jellyfish venom?
I've grown up being a long distance swimmer from the earliest age. In fact, my father says that he taught me to swim before I could walk. So I don't know that that's true, but I don't remember ever not knowing how to swim. So I've always been a swimmer. I'm originally from Alaska. I met my husband, who was from Hawaii, while I was in the PhD program at Georgetown, and he was at NIH. And after we got married and had three kids, his mother wanted him to come home. So we moved back to Hawaii 30 years ago, and I continued my swimming as I usually did, now with the treat of being able to swim in the ocean. And so I was swimming at the Kaimana Beach down to Queens Beach Wall and back. It's about a mile and a quarter, maybe, depending. And so one morning I went out to do the swim, and I like to avoid the sun, so it was about 6:15 before, dawn and first light. So it was kind of dark, but definitely swimmable. And an older lady was walking on the beach wearing a muumuu and had a tiny little white dog, and said, "Don't swim." And I said, "Why is that?" And she pointed to the beach, these little tiny clear like cellophane wrappers on the beach. And I said, "What's that?" And she said, "Well, these are box jellyfish." So I looked at them, and I really couldn't even see any tentacles. And she said, "They're very dangerous. Don't swim." And so I kind of, thanked her, and she walked away. And I looked at them, and I had my Lycra shorty on. And so I thought, well, they don't really look dangerous, and I've swum with, jellies in other parts of the world, and I think it should be okay. So I went off to do the swim, and as I was coming back in through the break by the windsock there, the tide was going out, and I ran across a whole group of these, and I didn't know what it was. I felt like a ghost fishing line or something on my neck with sharp bits, so I thought it was literally a ghost fishing line with hooks. So I tried to get it off, and it was stringy. And so I did a free dive down to the sand, which was about 12 feet right there where I was. And I came back up, and everywhere which wasn't covered by Lycra then was now covered with these sticky, stringy bits, which I finally understood looking back on it. This was a whole mass of box jellyfish going out a bit with the tide before dawn. In any event, immediately I was in horrible pain, shocking kind of deep piercing needle pains that felt like electrical shocks, and then I couldn't breathe. And I'm a Red Cross certified lifeguard from my teenage years, and I looked at the beach and there was no one there. I was still, early morning, and I couldn't breathe. Suddenly I felt like my lungs were filling with liquid. I was wheezing, gasping, and I was terrified. And I had this sudden sense of, this is how you die, because I didn't have the strength to yell. There was no one around. I wasn't able to swim. I was just, so I tried to, calm things down. I went on my back and I put my arms, extended them backwards to try to open up the lungs and get some air and try to get ahead of this whole, anxiety situation and just get into control. But nothing was working. Nothing worked. So then I'm like, okay, well, we got to do this somehow. So I just went into this very weak, ineffective breaststroke. I had the tide coming against me, going, pushing me out, and I wasn't making any progress. And I don't even remember after that. So it must have just went into muscle memory. So the next thing I remember was coming, rolling onto the sand and kind of being jostled awake and this searing pain everywhere. And nobody was around still. And so there was a freshwater shower. So I stumbled to my feet and I went to pull the shower. And I thought, oh, this would be lovely because it's a burning pain and that would resolve the pain. In fact, it was like it was burning oil coming out of the shower. It was ridiculously painful. And so now I'm just like unbelievably, confused about what it was I'm supposed to do. There was a phone and I had a little quarter in my Speedo under my shorty Lycra. So I went to the phone and tap or tried to call, but I couldn't talk because I was literally just wheezing, gasping. And so I tapped on the Waikiki glass door, the aquarium right there. And the next thing I knew, I was in an ambulance, and they had vinegar and meat tenderizer. They had wrapped me with Saran wrap, and I was new to Hawaii, and so I just was like, what are we doing? How is this medicine? So that was what got me into this whole field.
Wow. So you started your research then, right? Or, and that in 2013, you were recognized, right, as Scientist of the Year for your work. Is that correct? And then I read an article in the New Yorker that was written in 2015 about your work, right? Is that
Well,
correct?
my work has been recognized really. I wrote my first grant in 1997 to the Hawaii
Okay.
Community Foundation, and kudos to them for, supporting this, because I was not in the field at all. I'm just an old school biochemist. I didn't have any marine biology background, but it definitely had local relevance, and they liked the way that I was thinking in terms of rigorous biochemical research because that hadn't been done. But since really the early 2000s, I was recognized as a world leader because it's such a tiny field. So, they're like, you could count three people on both hands worldwide studying the biochemical composition of box jellyfish venoms. So it's a long neglected, strange, tiny little corner of the scientific universe.
Well, why don't you tell us about box jellyfish? Because I had no idea that you could die from a sting from a box jellyfish, and that their venom is the most powerful there is of some kind of creature like that. And their tentacles are really long. I had no idea. So why don't you tell us all about box jellyfish?
Well, so exactly, I ended up in an ambulance, and my husband's a physician, and so I was really embarrassed because, first of all, I didn't listen to the elderly lady that warned me. So it was kind of on me. So I felt really embarrassed to be wasting these EMT folks' time. They told me, no, we have to go to hospital because this is very serious and life-threatening. And I said, really, no, is there something else you could do? And they said, well, we could put you in the hot shower here at the aquarium, and that might start to resolve some of the pain. So they had me in a wheelchair and put me in the aquarium hot shower. And after about 15 minutes, I started to feel better. And 20 minutes, I said, okay, I think I'm really feeling fine. And so I actually signed out against medical advice, which we had a little bit of a fight over that, but I felt that there is no way I want to waste emergency room time on such a ridiculous thing as a jellyfish sting, right? So I drove myself back into Manoa, and I called my husband to meet me and to bring whatever he could for this kind of a sting. And halfway into Manoa at the light, the pain was back and doubled, and I was gasping for air again, and I was regretting signing out against medical advice. And I said, oh no, now I've really done it. Now I'm gonna die and wreck. So it was ridiculous. So I was just beside myself. How could this be so bad, right? And so I got home, and my husband came, and he tried everything he could think of, topical steroids, et cetera, et cetera. And nothing worked. So I went to hot baths and et cetera. Anyway, so my pride wouldn't let me, go to the ER, and I just soldiered through. But it was really 72 hours of excruciating pain. And the only thing that would really sort of do anything for it was really, really hot water soaking in that. So I wrote the grant proposal, really because I was intrigued and fascinated that something so small and ancient could be this bad, right? And when I started to do some research into the literature, I found, in fact, there were, many species of box jellyfish, Cubozoa, class Cubozoa, over 40, in fact, and two main families. The one we have in Hawaii, the four-tentacled families, we have at least three different species of those here. And then the larger one that has up to 15 tentacles per corner. So that 4 times 15, so 60 tentacles. And those tentacles are each 10 feet long, whereas our Hawaii Cubozoa has only four, like 3 feet long. They contract and extend. So there's magnificent diversity amongst class Cubozoa, box jellyfish, so many different species. So it isn't just one thing. But what they do share in common is this extremely potent venom, and the larger ones are associated with many lost lives, especially the Philippines, Thailand, Indonesia. So we don't have the larger group, the chiropodids, thankfully, here in Hawaii. But Hawaii and Florida, Caribbean, have enormous numbers of these box jellyfish, most of which are nighttime animals, and most of which live in pelagic environments, the deep ocean. So one doesn't see them, usually Fort Lauderdale, the beaches that we're used to thinking about. So they're an understudied group of organisms, but they're the most specialized of all the jellyfish. The class Cnidaria includes corals, anemones, as well as jellyfish, the jellies. And of the jellies, there's Scyphozoa and Hydrozoa, and then Cupozoa. So the round dinner plate animals are Scyphozoa, they're radially symmetrical, whereas the fourfold symmetry box Cubozoa have that body plan.
Okay, so in Hawaii, you're saying the one that has the four tentacles is what you will see. Is that correct? And that's what you studied mostly, or all?
Well, in Hawaii, we have actually more than one four-tentacled species. So we
Okay.
have Alatina alata, who's our pelagic animal that comes in to spawn once a month. And it's the only Cubozoa on the, in the world. This Alatina alata also is in Puerto Rico and in Florida, and it exists in other places. But amongst the 40 species of box jellies, it's the only one who has this spawning aggregation. So we can make a calendar.
Oh, that's
So,
interesting.
yeah.
Yes. So
So
now it's
other,
full moon. So
right.
it how
10
many
days,
10 days after?
8 to 10 days after the full moon, most of the stings occur. But these animals are out there every night of the month. It's just they're in the deeper ocean. So if you happen to go out at the night high tide, over their little constitutive cyclonic current, then you'll see them. But there's nobody out there. I mean, hopefully the deep ocean swimmers will avoid that area. But in any event, so the box jellies we have in Hawaii, the one that has the most stings, the most clinically relevant, is called Alatina alata, and it's been called Hawaiian box jellyfish. But there are two other species that are smaller that are often found in boat harbors.
Oh, okay. So tell us what they do that releases this venom that's so dangerous for people.
So the animal is has four eye stalks, and on each eye stalk it has six eyes, and two of the eyes are like our own with a lens that can focus and see color. They literally have a pupil, so under the microscope you can shine light and see the pupil retract, and then put it dark and see the pupil. So they have one eye that looks towards the center of their body and one eye that looks straight up. But they're on an eye stalk which can bend. So they literally have 360 degree visual capability. Then they have four other eyes, which are really just primitive visual organs that are composed of pigments that can basically take a structural change when a photon hits it. So they're basically your photo diode detectors at depth. So they can know that a photon or some very minute amount of light. They're not focusing. So anyway, these animals have magnificent visual capability, and they hunt. So they're hunting fish, and they have sensory hair cells in the tentacles that sense vibrational frequencies, the chemical makeup, they can taste. And then they also have a pressure sensor. So basically, they're hunting, looking for something that has a heartbeat and a mucin, looks like a fish, heartbeat like a fish, sting it. Okay. And so once they sting the fish, obviously, they're just made of gelatinous zooplankton. The fish has strong muscles. So the venom has to act very quickly, or the fish will tear the jelly apart, right? So these venoms were developed, or basically they predate fish. So back in the day, 600 million years ago, when the cnidaria first arrived on the scene, it was a battle for the substrate. So corals will attack one another with these venoms. And then similarly, the anemones. And then as cnidaria class became more specialized, we had the planktonic cnidaria, we have the jellies. So these jellies could eat one another, so they can attack each other. Anemone can eat jellies. So long before the vertebrates were on the scene in the oceans, there was a lot of warfare going on, and venom were part of the way in which they would feed. So these tiny stinging capsules basically line the tentacles, and they're microscopic. You can't see them with the naked eye, but each one of them contains a piercing element which unfolds, and it when it's unfolded, it has a physical properties that exceed surgical steel. So it's like being injected with millions of microscopic hypodermic needles, and what's inside each of these capsules, these nidae, is a cocktail of bioactive proteins and peptides and whatnot, and that's called the venom. So many of the hundreds of thousands of these tiny capsules then dump their contents into the skin and the capillaries, and that's a sting.
That's really scary. They survived 600 million years. They're very successful at what they do.
Well, so it turns out that they kind of overshot the mark with their venom, that they can deal with one another. Fish are kind of toast. And interestingly, the fish red blood cells has a nucleus. Now, it turns out that the same dose that would still or paralyze a tiny 60 gram fish, if you think of 10 nickel sizes, to stack up 10 nickels, 5 grams. I think that's about right. You would have the same amount of venom will affect a 60 kilogram adult.
Wow.
So, 150 pound adult. So the venom to venom, because we don't have nuclei in our red blood cells, and the fish do. So the fish can repair damage. But when we get injected with these venom, we are basically 1/1,000, 1,000th more sen or 1,000 times more sensitive to the venom than the fish is. So it's not as though these are vile, sinister creatures who have come to get us. We just don't belong in their food bucket because they're used to feeding on fish. And here we are, these fragile, vulnerable, red blood cell carrying folks with no nucleus. So once our red blood cell gets pierced, so the venom, the fastest acting agent in the venom, actually causes holes in any cell it touches. And so when it goes into the bloodstream, the number one cell in the bloodstream obviously are the red blood cells. So you have this whole downstream sequelae that's just caused by creating holes in cells, in the target cells, and in this case, red blood cells.
That's very scary. So explain to me if their habitat is in the deep ocean and they hunt at night, how is it that people who are swimming in Waikiki or swimming in Anini here are getting stung by box jellyfish, not here, but on Oahu?
Well, that's 90, percent of their lifetime is spent going up and down the water column in these deep pelagic environments. So they come up with a night high tide, as do most of the invertebrates of the deep sea. So the biggest migration of life on the planet are the oceans, and they are these invertebrates that come up to feed at the night high tide. So they go down again and up and down, but they are triggered the so there's a whole community out there in this cyclonic current area. We could do a waypoint and show you where they are. But then at the a certain number of days after the full moon, you basically have all these hours before moonrise, so it becomes walking back and back and back. So when they have so many hours before moonrise, so it's basically the absence of light after sunset before moonrise. We've figured this out and we've published on this. So basically, in the absence of light at this certain days after the full moon, you trigger the adults in that community to become sexually mature, and their gonads now do the last step of activation. And so that number, it's a small, fraction of the whole community, then makes their swim to the shore. So they do a spawning aggregation, a directional swim to the reef zone. And when they do that, they basically leave that area, and we've been out there around the night high tide, swim towards Waikiki, and now we find communities off of other parts of Oahu and the other islands. But they all do the same thing. So they all have a cohort in a little habitat in the deeper ocean in this kind of constitutive cyclonic current area. Then they'll swim specifically to the reef zone, at which point they mate. There's males and females, and the males are broadcast sperm fertilization. So the females take up the sperm and they have internal fertilization. They make these embryo strands, which then drop out. So the males and the females actually do this whole little courtship dance. So when we go out there between midnight and 5 a.m. to watch and see what's going on, we can see them doing this kind of swimming courtship dance. And so then once they spawn, and the females then after a day drop the embryo strand, then they perish. They took their toast. So they just, that's a one-way trip for them, and that's the end of their life. So if you are a swimmer and you're around at that 8 to 10 days and you're doing an early morning swim, then there's mature animals out there for sure. So you have a chance of being stung. Later in the day, there may be some that wash back in. So they still have tentacles and they get broken up in the surf zone. So you could get stung by, even pieces of tentacles of the jellies. But we, our surfers will ask us, when they're going out at 5 a.m., whatever, dawn patrol, they'll ask us, what's the count? How many jellies? And they might not want to go if the count is really high.
Well, that's really good information that you found out that they spawn 8 to 10 days after a full moon. So if people are asking you, like surfers, I know that they put out advisories for box jellyfish on, I see that all the time on the news. Be careful of what's out there. How do you do a count of box jellyfish when surfers are saying how many are out there? How do you
Well,
do
we
that?
have a control area and we count the number that beach in the control areas. And then, based upon extrapolation and 25 years of data, we
Right.
can make an assessment. But the point is good because sometimes the whole cohort seems to swim. Mostly they're at one Charlie, one Delta, the two Charlie, two Delta, sorry, near the Kapahulu Groin, so right by the zoo. Most of the time, that's ground zero. That's the highest density. But sometimes the whole cohort kind of heads off on another area, and so our area might not be as numerous as the others. But we get counts from the other areas as well. So we have a sense of how big of an influx it was.
I think that's amazing research, so that we can keep people safe on the beaches if there is going to be, a higher count of box jellyfish based on their mating to what you've researched, which I think is just phenomenal. Does before we go on to talk about kind of the common myths people do as you experienced, in 19 was it 1997 when this happened to you? Yeah, so. How does this relate to Portuguese man of war? Are they the same kind of animal? Do they have as bad a sting? And
No. So the cnidaria is the phylum, and the big phylum contains the corals, anemone, and then different types of medusozoa, the free swimming jellies. And so the most ancient are the hydrozoa, of which Portuguese man of war, more properly called blue bottle here in the Pacific. The Portuguese man of war, frankly, is supposed to be only referring to the Atlantic animals, which are
okay.
much bigger than ours.
Yeah.
They have a float of a foot.
Right. I've seen those in Florida.
Yeah. So ours, the Pacific animals are called blue bottle, and they're Physalia utriculus. So they're a more ancient group within phylum Cnidaria. Their venom is less potent, but their Cnidae, the tubule that injects the venom, actually goes deeper. So it has more of a physical wounding. You can imagine you've got all these pierce, where these tiny microscopic hypodermic needles pierce through your skin. So the Physalia tubules actually go deeper than the Alaetina alata. Neither one of those go as deep as the animals, the chiropods in Australia and Philippines, but that's a different topic. But locally, so the trauma is worse from the Physalia, just the physical trauma, wounding, but then the venom is less sophisticated and actually rather rapidly resolving, even if you did nothing for the most part. But in both cases, these venoms are highly heat labile, so you don't have to, boil your person to inactivate the venom. Just using safe hot water is enough to do some proper first aid to inhibit the venom, and it's irreversibly inhibited.
So you're talking about box jellyfish, and then, as I mentioned before we started this interview, someone I knew was stung, they said, by a jellyfish. So in Kauai, and I know the box jellyfish aren't really here, is that correct?
No, that's not correct. They
Okay.
are definitely there.
All right.
And we've collected some over there. Your community is smaller and they're more offshore, but we do have, absolute Alaetina alata in Kauai.
Okay. Are there other kinds of jellyfish that people could have been stung by that?
Well, the big ones in Hawaiian waters are the blue bottle, and then there are two other species of Alaetina. which kind of have a tiny sting, and they mostly live in harbors, boat harbors. But they're not medically significant.
Okay. So before we get on to the myths of how we treat things, tell me about Australia and the Philippines. Have you worked with them with your protocols?
Oh yes, yeah.
Okay. So tell us about that, because Australia always has things that are so extreme that kill you that I'd like to know about how that has played out for them with your protocol.
Well, so Australia is certainly, I mean, the most vocal of the Indo-Pacific neighbors in proclaiming the danger of their critters and the health burden, the impact. But frankly, it's not true. I've been now 15 times in field work in the Philippines, 5 times in Australia. In fact, I'm going back November 1st through the 15th to north end of Cape York near Torres Strait in Papua New Guinea. I've done multiple field efforts in Thailand, Indonesia. So that whole area has chiropodids and deaths. So these animals are much bigger than ours, as we mentioned. They have 60 10-foot long tentacles. The body is basically 1 foot by 1 foot by 1 foot, about the size of a basketball. So they're huge, massive creatures. And they are seasonally in the Philippines at the hottest and driest times of the year. So where we go in Lucena, in the Visayas, and different areas where there's mangrove rich kind of swampy areas right next to a bay, that's their preferred habitat. And most of the deaths are children under 12, and most of the areas where they're stung is in water less than 3 feet deep, usually about 2 feet deep. And these are kids from, 18 months old, sitting in his mom's arms as she's sitting in a foot and a half water. And one of these box jellies comes grazing by, and just the grazing sting was enough to kill her baby. So, I mean, the health burden in the Philippines is the highest in the world. So, I have a whole research program to do outreach, and it's a humanitarian effort. So, we're always doing fundraising to bring first aids to the Philippines to reduce those deaths. So, whereas the Australians kind of get the limelight, and they've got a lot of BBC, friendly, articulate, big Australian folks who kind of can beat their chest about these things. It's not untrue. There certainly are chiropodists in Australia, but they've been so good about educating the folks. So they have these huge 10-foot high stainless steel signs next to a beach where there would be chiropodists, and they have the big, sturdy Australian family all in their stinger suits from head to toe, including their little mittens of lycra. So they're telling the people, from this time of the year to this time of the year, these huge box jellies are here. If you're going to go in the water, don't. But if any other time, wear these stinger suits, and here's the emergency numbers. And then, so they're just very proactive. Whereas in the Philippines, with 7,000 islands, and basically zero infrastructure, a lot of these vulnerable places are cashless fisher folk societies which do bartering. So there's no way that the Philippines could have the public health outreach that Australia does. So Australia has very few deaths, maybe a couple dozen over 50 years. Whereas the Philippines, we don't even know because there's not mandatory reporting. And so, folks have estimated at least 50 deaths a year, and most of these are children.
Oh, that's really remarkable information, because that's very sad. And I'm glad you're working on that humanitarian effort, Dr. Angel. So now we're talking about water safety education. You're saying Australia is proactive. What can you tell people about what's effective first aid versus the myths that you need to retire? Because I see a lot of people doing a lot of different things. As you said, epinephrine was used to begin with, maybe to deal with box jellyfish stings. So, what now is the protocol? What do you say to people? What can you say to our listeners?
Well, I think the most important thing to say to the listeners is that, tap the brakes here, because too often, and the US public has been kind of spoiled for a long period of time in that we had, cutting edge, rigorous research sort of driving the boat. But more and more, we have kind of these big proclamations. Listen to me, I'm the authority. So any authority-based recommendations, do what we had the bumper stickers back in the 70s, question authority, right? Okay,
Yes.
so what I'll do after our podcast here is send you my published, peer-reviewed published literature. So
Great.
we should start there. So we
Okay.
should start with requiring evidence-based
Yes.
recommendations,
Yes.
because there are plenty of loud voices. There's one in Australia right now who went front page Sydney Morning Herald, vinegar can kill. Now, what was that based on? It was based on one paper with an N of three with a 60% error. It wasn't even humans, or and it doesn't bear out when you do retrospective epidemiologic studies.
Correct.
So what I want to say first to your listeners is put on your skeptical hat, and be the prove it to me person. So, and it should be proven to you through primary literature, through peer-reviewed literature. So when I first got stung, I wasn't treated with epinephrine. Epinephrine actually is not a typical intervention. That's something that only medical professionals might use. Unfortunately, there's a whole reason why epinephrine is counterindicated in managing severe box jellyfish stings, but that might be a little bit beyond the scope of your podcast. But typically, what had been done, and by most indigenous people around the world, in fact, is to douse with vinegar was one, to pack the person in hot sand. That was common amongst the Aboriginals in Australia. So then, kind of modern medicine, we get into the writing textbooks in medical school textbooks, and then textbooks started echoing each other. So I've done some historical, sleuthing here, and one of the big recommendations from the first world, I think you might even find it still on Cleveland Clinic and Mayo Clinic websites, is making a paste out of baking soda and scraping with a credit card. Well, where did that come from? Well, it came from clinicians in England with regard to treating bee stings, and reasonings from their armchair, in Liverpool or London or wherever they were, that how different could bee stings be from jellyfish stings? Just little tiny things poking in your body. Let's just put a paste on it and scrape it. Well, in fact, it doesn't really make a big difference for the scyphozoan stings, like the sea nettles on the east coast of the US. Almost whatever you do, it's going to be painful, and but you wouldn't kill someone. Whereas in Australia, or sorry, more interestingly, in the Philippines, where people went into the literature to search how to deal with this, my child's been stung by a box jellyfish. Oh, get baking soda. Child died. Okay, we have so many cases in which using ammonia, baking soda, scraping, ice, all of these things which you could sort of get away with, they weren't evidence-based, management to begin with. They were just concocted out of somebody's, thinking, which should always be evaluated in multiple stages before being recommended and put in the text of a U.S. medical textbook. But in any event, so the things not to do. We've actually studied all of these with a blood auger model. So there's such a thing as blood auger, which is like a gel that's made with intact red blood cells. And every hospital uses these when you have a kid that might have strep throat. They'll swab the throat and put that swab onto this lawn of red blood cells in a gel. And the bacteria will grow. And if they're pathogenic bacteria, they produce something which bursts red blood cells. So then after 6 hours or so, you can see a clear zone where the red blood cells were burst by the bacterial toxins. So similarly, if we add our tentacle interestingly, onto the blood auger, it spontaneously stings. You know, does it taste right? We don't know why it does that, but it does. And you can watch with the naked eye over time this zone of hemolysis. So all of this is published, and your listeners can have access to these
Right.
papers. And so we can now ground truth different first aids. Okay, we can make a skin so you have a barrier function, lay the tentacle on the skin, it stings through the skin into the blood auger, and now we try different things. We put baking soda, we scrape, we add seawater, we scrape, we do ice pack, we do this, we do that. And so we've done these huge matrix experiments, and then what we found without fail amongst the whole class cnidaria was the best no harm first aid was to douse with vinegar. Vinegar does not get into the bloodstream and inhibit the venom already there, but it prevents more stinging. So every time you touch a tentacle, only a few fire. You have so many stuck onto your skin, they're very sticky, that haven't yet fired, but they're like ticking time bombs. They will fire. Once you get into a fresh shower or you scrub it with sand or whatnot, you cause more to fire. So you've made it worse. So if the first aid is doused with vinegar, then those tiny capsules that haven't yet fired actually adsorb water and they change their architecture, and they're so very intricately made that if they've swollen, they can no longer fire. So they can some of them rupture on the side, but they can't purposefully fire. So first to douse with vinegar, and then interestingly, this hot water, 42 to 45, about 110, 115 Fahrenheit, for at least 30-minute immersion. So that inhibits the pore forming step. So these pore forming toxins have to find each other. They have to form like this string of pearls. Once they find each other and assemble, they sit down on the red blood cell, and then all hell breaks loose basically at that point. So you want to prevent that from happening. So the hot water immersion does that. Now, by trying lots of other things and through looking at molecular model of the amino acid structures, we found a better agent, which is copper, copper gluconate, a particular valence state of copper. Not every copper will, but this copper gluconate. So we've compounded now in this two-part first aid, which is vinegar plus urea plus copper is a spray, and then a base that a Lipoderm, which is a professional pharmaceutical compounding base, plus copper as a topical. So
Well,
that's the high-end first aid versus what off the rack anybody just vinegar dousing and then safe hot water immersion for at least 30 minutes.
so let's just say I'm a tourist, or maybe I'm just a local person. I get stung, I come out, but I've carried my vinegar because I've heard that vinegar works. I douse the person because this is an anecdotal study, a story I just heard. Somebody was at a nini, and the person came in, a visitor, and she had her vinegar and she poured it on his back, and it was just fine. That was perfect. But you're telling me you need the hot water piece.
Well, it was perfect. What kind of a sting did he have? Visalia?
I don't know. I don't know.
So, I mean, vinegar is truly not a first aid because a first aid should reverse the pathology. So it prevents things from getting worse.
Right.
But dousing with vinegar will prevent the undischarged cnidaria, so it clears the site,
Right.
it prevents it from getting worse. If it's a Physalia sting, for the most part, these are already self-resolving. They only act for so many seconds or minutes.
Okay.
If it's a very deep wound in very thin skin in a young child or elderly person, then the dose is higher. But for an adult man on thick skin in the back, dousing with vinegar is absolutely appropriate first step response, but it isn't a treatment by
Correct.
in
So,
the most specific point of view.
yes. So, what I see is the combination is the best.
Correct.
Okay.
So I'll send you the all of the peer-reviewed work
Thank
that
you.
goes to
But
say that.
I want to talk about Diana Nyad and your contribution to her swim. But before that, Sting No More is what you just talked about. It's your
Correct.
formula that you can get on stingnomore.com. And if you
Yes.
could send me a link to that, because I feel, why wouldn't I just have that? Why shouldn't I just have that on me
Well,
instead
if
of.
you could, that would be the ideal.
Now, is this available in
Yes.
places all over? Probably dive shops probably carry your product. Is that correct? Or
Well, across the state of Hawaii, I think there's about a dozen, 2 dozen vendors. Certain ABC stores have it. Four Seasons Maui has it. Aaron's
a
Dive Shop has
hotel
it.
should have it. That would just
Well,
be great.
so I was funded originally from the U.S. military because there were career-ending combat diver stings, and so part of the grant required that I include a reduction to practice and a business plan. I'm a full-time academic.
Right.
I told them I didn't have time for that. And they said, oh, no, we need a proposal from you. And I kind of fought them. And they said, look, all you have to do is contact the School of Business and the College of Pharmacy. They can help you with these things. They're not that hard to do. So I finally did all that. And then I found something that worked. I mean, just remarkably across the board, this copper gluconate. So I partnered with Hilo School of Pharmacy, and I partnered with folks at Manoa School of Business to do the reduction to practice. So we have the, and it has to be available to the public. So we have this little website, which does not look professional. It's stingnomore.com, but
Right.
it's required because of the federal of the military funding required that it be available. But frankly, a proper entrepreneur should pick this up and bring it because it gets ordered worldwide, and we've spent zero on advertising, and this year-over-year sales keep building, and we kind of
We
kid
should do something about this,
our
don't you?
compounding pharmacist that we need to kind of keep the on the down low because otherwise, so it's a economy of scale. But go
I think
ahead.
it's a great product. I'm going to order some, but
Okay.
and I will tell everybody too. But how do you know how many people are stung? Is there any Department of Health research? I mean, data on that or?
Well, the month that I ended up in an ambulance, there were 1,000 stings reported in Waikiki. So some months it's just, off the hook in terms of the numbers.
Is this month going to be bad? We're now at a full moon and we're how many days
I
till the
can't predict
spawning?
it. It
Yeah,
you
you
really
can't
can't
predict
predict
it.
it. No.
All right. So let's, before we do NIAID, what message would you give people for this, to, schools and just lifeguards and visitors as a form of messaging? I know the guards are aware of all this because they'll say something about it, right, when they're around or not. I don't
Well,
know.
I might step on some toes right now, but just forgive me because
That's okay. We're all here.
you've asked me. So what I would say is, I'm kind of upset about ocean safety, city and county. It seems that I haven't checked in lately, but it seems the last I heard that the first aid that they were putting out was ice packs. And ice packs, in fact, the reason for that is that it has to be something that can be at every lifeguard stand in the state.
How
And
about
so
your formula?
it's a dry thing that you can add water to and get cold. But all of the data, my papers, all the retrospective show worse outcome with the application of ice or cold. Now, that being said, here comes a stung person and they're in great pain. We put ice on them and we ask them their pain score for 10 minutes and their pain goes down. Okay, so it looks like it's working. An hour after that, though, it's back on and it's tenfold. So if at the beginning you had put heat pack on them and the pain goes down, and an hour later it stays down. So this is all published literature. Basically, the cold super activates the venom. It stops biology for a moment. As long as they're right there next to the lifeguard stand, things look good. But then they get home or to their hotel, and then they end up showing up in the ER 6 hours later And now they have much more pathology. They've got real wounding, they've got huge inflammation, they've got all kinds of other problems. So this isn't just my work. We've done retrospectives of worldwide first aid. So I'll send you those papers as well. I mean, I'd like to get ocean safety off of this idea that it doesn't matter if it's hot or cold. And now it's true, it doesn't matter while they're next to you. But it does matter with regard to outcomes. And that's what we should care about. We should care about the outcome 24 hours later. I've had people call me who were stung days or weeks ago, and they're still suffering all kinds of complications because they didn't have the right first aid from the beginning. So if we could get the state of Hawaii to at least have a uniform treatment plan of or mitigation of dousing of vinegar and then hot packs that stay on the site for at least 30 minutes, we could have moved the needle towards a positive, better outcomes.
So I would say, because I was just talking to Kalani Vieira, is going to be on the show in November, who's head of the Hawaii Lifeguard Association and also part of OSB here on Kauai. It makes sense to me that why aren't they all in their packs carrying your product? It makes total sense because you're saying, yes, for the moment, it doesn't hurt, but then that visitor or that local person goes back and ends up in the hospital or some other stressful situation. And that doesn't make sense at all. It makes sense to use a product, and they should at least be test pilot to say, let's try it out here on this island, this product that you've done evidence-based research to show that this works.
Well, so in the Philippines, where refrigeration isn't an option for most of the places where I'm working, we make a double strength spray, and it's been life-saving. So having kind of an all-in-one spray, so it has
Right.
vinegar plus urea plus the double strength copper. So the cream is sort of a first world luxury because it gets right into the bloodstream quickly in this very sophisticated base, but it's fussy. It has to be refrigerated. But when you're stung, you have all these little trauma wound sites. So basically, even in the context of vinegar and urea, you can get that copper into the wound sites. So, I mean, in terms of, having something else on the shelf throughout the state of Hawaii, that might be a good first step. Because I agree that it'd be hard for them to all have, co kept cool Sting No More cream. That I think that originally was part of the pushback, that it was a bit too fussy for them to have. But because we've had to kind of go there with regard to helping in the Philippines, we now have 10 years of data. And so this Sting No More has been available, over the counter for over 10 years and, over 60,000 units sold, and no adverse responses ever recorded. So it's safe, it's effective, and the spray is very hardy and, a good shelf life and robust. The cream, there are some comments about that, but if you have a really bad sting, you would like the cream because that gets the proper concentration over the entire area of the sting, and it's just easier to manage than a drippy spray.
Well, I think that makes sense, and it's based on, peer-reviewed research. I just think what you said about ice packs is really, the problem here. That's contraindicative to any kind of sting. So, yes, it's gonna numb it for a while, but it'll come back, probably even worse from what you're saying. Okay, so we've got OSB we can work on. I'll talk to Kalani and see what he can do about grabbing some of this and having it in there at their towers for sure. I don't understand why they don't want to or haven't thought about it or whatever, but it's certainly an issue you've brought up. What else could you say to schools or, I don't know, visitors in general about not putting ice? Put vinegar and hot water is kind of what you're saying is a remedy, and possibly buying your product, Sting No More.
Well, first of all, to the visitors and maybe even to the Hawaii tourism, is a little better signage because It turns out that a lot of our folks go swimming. I've been out there collecting jellies in a full wetsuit with gloves and seeing skinny dippers, at 3 a.m. And we're saying, like, we're collecting very dangerous box jellies right now. You might not want to be swimming. Oh, we'll watch out for them. They're drunk, they're nude, it's dark. And then just wait for it. And then you hear the cry, ah, what do we do? What do we do? And so, but too often, these are foreign folks who don't even, understand. So I think that the beaches should all have better, pictures of the jelly, exactly when they're going to come, the maybe a replaceable sort of general calendar for the year, for the next 6 months, more signage and more warning. So you have folks coming from around the world and they see on the plane the little video about Hawaii flora and fauna and, don't bring pests here, et cetera. But there's never any mention about box jellyfish, when and where they are. So it feels a little bit like there could be more information on the front end, at least to protect tourists. The towers don't get their lifeguards until 8 or 9 a.m. and we see a great deal of stings between 6 and 8 a.m. So early morning, and then basically they'll put up a jelly sign if they've had so many stings. It's almost reactive rather than proactive. And then, in terms of just telling children to wear rash guards and to have better coverage, during this time, or to have little brochures in hotels. I just feel like we could do a better job in the front end, in the public education piece.
Well, I definitely would agree with you because everybody I know I've spoke to, you were going to come on. Nobody knows anything about them and how to really treat it. They're just try to stay away. And I never see any information here about jellyfish. I'll see them, kind of on the sand sometimes. I read somewhere where the wind will bring them here. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct. The wind will bring Physalia, the blue bottle, because it has a little float. It has an actual sail. So they sail with the wind. But the Alaetina alata, the Cubozoa, are incredibly strong swimmers. We've been out there scuba divers with, fiber optics with Discovery Channel. I was doing a special about my work and the animals, and we couldn't keep up with the jellies. I mean, they're better swimmers than we were. So they're going against a 90-degree current or directly into the current. And they are magnificent swimmers. So they're not being blown around. They are very strong, purposeful swimmers.
So the blue bottle, which we probably have more of here, you would say the pro we could use Sting No More.
Yes.
That. Okay, good. We've got that settled. This is really very interesting. It's almost like talking about octopi or something, which I never knew much about and how smart they are. Do you see box jellyfish as being an intelligent
Oh,
creature?
yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like they're always one step ahead of me. I mean, I'm out there collecting and I've got all my PPE, my double wetsuit and all this wood, but there's a little wee tiny crack at the top of my booty. I get stung. I'm like, really? That just happened.
Well, now I want to segue into something I found really interesting. You worked with Diana Nyad, the marathon swimmer who swam 100 some miles from Cuba to Florida. And she tried this five times. The fifth time was she was successful. And in that time, she researched and found you because she needed someone who could help her not get stung. And if she did, survive it enough to make the swim. So tell us about your work there and the film. And obviously, it wasn't as accurate because, but anyway, you go ahead and explain it because I thought it was very interesting.
I think it was the summer of 2011. I got this email out of the blue, and I get a lot of these. And it was all this single space and all these questions. And I'm like, oh my God, what is this? And they were asking all these detailed questions about box jellyfish and this and that and this and that and how they work and what to do. And I looked at the name. And so I did a Google of the name and I saw Diana Nyad at a TED Talk. So I listened to her TED Talk and I just fell in love with this person. I'm like, who is this person? This is amazing. The will and the strength of this person and the vision. And it was just like she grabbed me right away by just the passion of her life. And so I went back to read her email and I took the time to respond, and I, you know, she had like 45 questions. So it took like 4 pages of a response, and I gave her detailed responses with citations of everything. And then I sent it and it was crickets. And I'm like, oh, well, I just wasted my time, whatever. And so then, I don't know, maybe a week later, I get an email back and it's all in 16-point font. And I go, oh no, what happened? And it's CC with, you know, all these people. And it's like, who are you? I'm like, oh no, what have I done? And this person is a wacko. So I start reading it. It's just, first of all, Angel, I have to tell you, I am ever so grateful. And everything she was writing was good. And I'm like, I calmed down a little bit. But right away, I thought that this person was a total, you know, coming at me hot there. But anyway, so I responded and we went back and forth. And then she says, well, I need you to come to talk to my team. And I said, well, I don't know that I could do that. And it turned out her team was in Key West. And that's where my divers, the Special Forces School, who was funding my work was. So I said, well, actually, I have to go give a briefing and I'll be there at this time. And she's perfect. Come talk to us too. So I went over to talk to them and I met with her medical team and I gave them all the data and, you know, had some prototypes that I was giving to the military. And I said, you could try this and blah, blah, blah. And so they were all about it. And then it was like a 3-day weekend meeting, and I was going back and forth to the military folks. And then at the end, she said, well, we'd like to talk to you and want you to come with us to Cuba to do the swim, be on board. And I said, well, no, that's not possible. I'm a professor at UH. There's no way I can do that. And then they kept pestering me. And then they had this little meeting and set up, they had a rental house and then the second floor, and there's a room, and there's like 10 of them in the room. And then they said, we really need you to come. They wanted to chat to me. So they had a little chat and then they kind of zeroed in on me. And I'm like, oh, wait a minute, this was a setup. And I said, no, I frankly, I absolutely could not do that, you know. And they kept pestering one by one. And then they fell silent. And I looked at their face, especially Bonnie and Diana, and I just saw the terror in Bonnie's eyes. And I could imagine this will happen again. And if I'm not on board, this woman could die. And
Right.
now it would be on me because I would have been the one to say no. So my heart melted at that point. And I said, you know, okay. But this meant me flying because you can't fly directly to Cuba and getting, you know, authorization from U.S. State Department, Treasury Department, all this stuff. It was not easy to do. But I got myself, and so for the fourth attempt, I was on the vessel. And things were going well. But our boat almost sank. So
Right.
we hit this huge squall and it was game over. So then for the next year, they asked me again, and I agreed again. And so this time, but anyway, with my technology, she was able to swim through box jellies at night. So it wasn't the film misrepresented a few things. My contribution was not the silicone mask. I opposed that. It didn't work. It gave her blisters. My contribution was the preventative Sting No More. And also the treatment. And then I was in the water with her as her swimmer from dusk to dawn. And we saw no sharks. And I was free diving all night long down to the thermocline to assess the danger we were in, and then dealing with her it, preventive wise according to the danger. So when we got into a box jellyfish zone at night, pelagic box jellies on the surface, we had her totally suited in Lycra, and then the preventative Sting No More and lanolin on her face, and kept up with that. And then I was swimming right next to her. You know, I was free to, I had fins and a snorkel, but I was in the water with her all night long, every night. So I was between, I
Gosh.
was keep protecting my swimmer here from
Oh my gosh.
who knows what, sharks and
That was
whatnot.
not represented. I mean,
No, it wasn't. I'm not Chinese. I'm not 20, and I'm a lot crazier than they showed. So.
So dusk to dawn, you were swimming and you had Sting No More on also. Did you get stung at all during this?
Oh yeah, I've been stung so many times. But well, as we approached Key West and it was dawn, and that we had passed through the danger zone. Then I finally got out of the water to take a quick nap, because basically of her 53 hours of swimming, I was awake like all but four of them. So I was totally in it too. I was available and just as, horribly sleep deprived. So I went over to the boat because we were just now coming up to Key West and we were good. And so I went to take a tiny little power nap. I get to the bunk on the other boat and I hear, "Diana told us you told her she could take off the Lycra." And I said,
Oh
"I did not say that." And they said, "Well, she did." And I got out, bolted back to the Voyager, jumped in the water, and I was swimming in front of her, and we came to a box jellyfish. And I picked it up with my bare hands because I didn't have enough time to get totally suited up because Diana was right there with her bathing suit. She would have run right into that box jellyfish. So I picked it up with my bare hands. I swam to Voyager. I told her, "Get me a bucket, and I said, "What do you have?" And I said, "Just get me a bucket." So they had a bucket. And so I had this horrible sting on my arm from where I had just picked up this box jellyfish, but we got all the divers in the water at that point, swimming in front of her. She wouldn't put her lycra back on, but right at the lip of the, it happened to be 8 to 10 days after the full moon, and there are jellies, the Alatina, that species, over the lip. We're coming up from a sea floor of 250 to 110, and so over that lip is a any kind of vertical structures is an area where you'd have more chance of encountering these.
Well, I just think what you did, so she was successful on that swim, speaks a lot about your research and your product. I just really commend you for that, and I think Hawaii should be using your research to treat people on the beach. I mean, it just makes total
Well,
sense to me.
it's all University of Hawaii work, so
Yes,
Hawaii should
exactly.
benefit.
Yes, I agree. Thank you, Dr. Angel Yana. I can't pronounce it right. Yana Kiara, thank you so much for coming on. And I look forward to reading your research that you're going to give me. And we will become a podcast the beginning of this year. We're at KKCR, which is kind of a jungle, shack and, in a small island. But this has really been a good show because people have been learning about water safety, and we've been trying to have people locally, nationally, internationally, and really showcase evidence-based research so people get the real right information to make, smart choices about what they do in the water. So what you presented today was really remarkable. I really appreciate it so much.